and on and on. Most days I would then go meet with the Attorney General to brief her or him on the most important matters. During the Obama administration, I worked with two Attorneys General, Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch. They were each intelligent and personable lawyers, and I liked them both. Holder was close to President Obama and his senior team and very attentive to the policy and political implications of the department's work. By the time I became director, his relationship with Republicans in Congress was toxic, with the Republican-led House of Representatives having voted to hold him in contempt for his failure to provide information to their satisfaction about an ATF gun trafficking investigation on the southwest border, known as Fast and Furious. The feeling of contempt seemed to be mutual. Loretta Lynch was much quieter and new to Washington. She spoke little, and when she did, frequently seemed tightly scripted. It always takes time to become comfortable in a high-profile job. I'm not sure Lynch's brief tenure gave her that time. And where Holder had a close working relationship with his Deputy Attorney General, Lynch's relationship with Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates seemed distant and strained. It was as if they and their staffs simply didn't talk to each other. My days were consumed by both emergencies and the disciplined execution of priority programs. I was trying to transform the way the FBI approached leadership, cyber, diversity, and intelligence, among other things, which required regular CEO, or director, focus to drive them forward. And the FBI is also an international enterprise, with people in every state and more than 80 countries. That meant I needed to travel to see, listen to, and speak to the people of the FBI. In my first 15 months as director, I visited all 56 FBI offices in the United States and more than a dozen overseas. I went there to listen and learn about the people of the FBI. What are they like? What do they want? What do they need? I spent hours and hours meeting them and listening to them. The first thing that struck me was that 2/3 of the FBI employees are not gun-carrying special agents. They are an extraordinarily diverse array of talented people from all walks of life, serving the FBI as intelligence analysts, linguists, computer scientists, hostage negotiators, surveillance specialists, lab experts, victim specialists, bomb technicians, and in many other roles. The 1/3 who are special agents, especially the thousands who were drawn by love of country after 9/11 to service in the FBI, are similarly diverse. Former cops and Marines, but also former teachers, chemists, therapists, clergy, accountants, software engineers, and professional athletes. Many of them look like TV special agents, tall, attractive men and women in business dress. But they come in all shapes and sizes, from crew cuts to ponytails, from ankle tattoos to hijabs, from 6'10" to 4'10". What drives them all is a palpable sense of mission. They helped me rewrite the organization's mission statement to match what was already written on their hearts. They exist to protect the American people and uphold the Constitution of the United States. I was amazed at the talent, but I was frightened by one trend. The special agent workforce since 9/11 had been growing steadily more white. When I became director, 83% of the special agents were non-Hispanic Caucasians. As I explained to the workforce, I had no problem with white people. But that trend is a serious threat to our effectiveness. In a country that is growing more diverse, which in my view is wonderful, if every agent looks like me, we are less effective. 83% could become 100% very quickly if the FBI became known as that place where white people work. I told the workforce that the challenge and the opportunity were captured in something one of my daughters said when I told her about our diversity crisis. "The problem, Dad, is that you are the man. Who wants to work for the man?" My daughter was right, but also wrong. Because if people knew what the men and women of the FBI are really like, and what the work is really like, they would want to be part of it. Almost nobody leaves the FBI after becoming a special agent. Whether white or black, Latino or Asian, male or female, the annual turnover is about the same, 0.5%. Once people experience the environment and the mission at the FBI, they become addicted to it and stay until retirement, despite being paid government salaries and working under incredible stress. "Our challenge," I told the FBI, "is simply to get out there and show more people of color and more women," that number had been stuck just below 20% for years, "what the place is like, and dare them to try to be part of it. It's not rocket science, I said. The talent is out there. They just don't know what they're missing. So we made it our passion to show them. And in just 3 years, the numbers started to change in a material way. During my third year at the FBI, a huge new agent class at Quantico was 38% non-white. Our standards hadn't changed. We were just doing a better job of showing people the life they could make by joining us, which is contagious in a positive way. My travels around the country and the world taught me something else. The FBI's leaders weren't good enough. In the private sector, I had learned that the best organizations obsess over leadership talent. They hunt for it, test it, train it, and make it part of every conversation. They treat leadership talent like money. At the FBI, though, leadership was largely an afterthought. For decades, the organization counted on good people volunteering to be leaders, and then putting up with all the family moves and time at Washington headquarters that required. Fortunately, many good people volunteered. But that kind of approach was also a recipe for people becoming leaders to escape a job they weren't doing well, or people being promoted by their bosses to get rid of them. I discovered from listening to the employees that we had some great leaders, some crappy leaders, and everything in between. That was simply not acceptable for an organization as important as the FBI. I told the organization that I had an ambitious goal. The FBI would one day be the government's premier leadership factory, and private employers would count the days until an FBI leader could retire, age 50 for special agents, so they could hire them to lead. The FBI would become so good at identifying and growing leaders that all the burdens of government leadership borne by FBI families would be repaid by successful second careers in the private sector. I told our employees that the military services were great organizations, but there was no reason why the FBI shouldn't be the dominant government supplier of America's corporate leaders. I said we were going to paint a picture of what great leadership looks like, find and grow those who could be great, and teach or remove those already in leadership jobs who weren't getting it done. With broad support across the organization, I was going to drive leadership into every corner and every conversation in the FBI until we were consistently excellent across all roles and at all levels. We would teach that great leaders are 1. People of integrity and decency, 2. Confident enough to be humble, 3. Both kind and tough, 4. Transparent, and 5. Aware that we all seek meaning in work. We would also teach them that 6. What they say is important, but what they do is far more important because their people are always watching them. In short, we would demand and